You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
we have a very big problem and a very dangerous problem for the world with North Korea.
Who doesn't? But why, following this week's missile launches, is China suggesting that it's President Donald Trump's job to calm North Korea down? My guests Samira Shackle and John Everard will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including whether or not your television is watching you, chaos on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, remarkably chaotic even for a proverbially chaotic region, and Nike's innovation in religiously correct sportswear. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Samira Shackle, freelance journalist writing for The New Statesman, The Guardian, Al Jazeera, Deutsche Welle, and Monocle, and John Everard, former British diplomat, previously Britain's ambassador to Uruguay, North Korea, and Belarus. Welcome both. And we will look first at North Korea, which continued its ongoing onslaught against the Sea of Japan earlier this week with another barrage of four ballistic missiles. One further is believed to have stalled on the launch pad. The subsequent diplomatic maneuverings have been, if any, anything even more perplexing, with China, though condemning the launch, suggesting that the United States could and or should be doing more to reduce tensions on the peninsula. John, first of all, this strange statement from the Chinese, which did suggest that maybe in a bid to calm Pyongyang down, like such a thing is ever possible, America might want to rethink its annual exercises with the South Koreans. This is their annual joint exercise, Fall Eagle. This came from China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi. Is it possible that he is conveying a message, hopeless though he knows it is?
Yes, he is almost certainly conveying a message, and it is indeed hopeless. The Chinese are clinging desperately to the idea that if you all sit around a table, that you could have a civilized conversation and sort all this out peacefully. I think very few North Korea watchers believe that there's much mileage in that idea right now. Tensions are running very high, and the North Koreans have made very clear that they are in no mood to talk to anybody very much. Worse, Wang Yi is trying to say that this is really a problem between North Korea and the United States, that China is just an honest broker, a bystander, nothing to do with us, Governor, as they say on the streets of London.
if not the streets of Beijing so often.
Quite so. This is, of course, completely disingenuous. China is a major player in this conundrum, and trying to wash its hands of what is going on simply is not going to work.
Samira, as a general principle, is there any point in even trying to think of concessions one could possibly make to a regime like North Korea?
I can't think of any off the top of my head, to be honest, and I think that the fact that sort of diplomatic efforts over the last few decades, in fact, diplomatic efforts coupled with sanctions, etc., haven't been effective whatsoever, as we've seen in the recent spate of action, and you know, sort of at various other points over the years as well. So I don't know really if there is much. I think the sort of offering concessions, that sort of carrot and stick approach of diplomacy and sanctions, works if a country feels it has something to lose, or if it feels like it wants to build bridges with the outside world with a state that's quite consciously isolationist and disinterested in currying favour. I think it's quite difficult to see what would change in the immediate future.
But John, is it possible that China thinks it can use this to leverage concessions in a different realm out of a potentially more amenable interlocutor, which is, the United States? Because obviously the other thing that has been going on is the United States has been deploying these THAAD missiles in South Korea, about which China is extremely displeased.
China is extremely displeased.
So is it possible that the Chinese are hoping that somehow, if they can't get America to back off on the joint exercise with South Korea, they might get America to back off on the missiles?
It's possible that that is what they're hoping. There's a lot of comment going around the American blogosphere right now saying simply China just doesn't get it. These deployments are going ahead not because anybody is out to get China, far from it, but because the North Korean missile threat is real and dangerous, and something has to be done to prevent it. One of the reasons that the North Koreans fired four missiles, tried to fire five, as you rightly said at the beginning, the last time round, was because they were trying to demonstrate that even with that system in place, they can swamp it by firing missiles in salvos rather than as individually. So, yes.
Samira, given what we've been discussing, the sort of rancor and bewilderment between China and the United States, each trying to hand responsibility for this off to each other, I'm going to freight this question with the traditional preemptive apology I always offer whenever I ask anybody to explain the thinking of the regime in North Korea. But is it possible that this kind of rancor and confusion is exactly what they want to provoke every time they take another series of pot shots at the blameless fish of the Sea of Japan?
Yeah, as you say, it's hard to know with any certainty, but I certainly can't imagine that anyone in Pyongyang is displeased by that sort of rancor and confusion, as you put it, between two major world powers. I mean, China's ostensibly an ally, but I mean, I don't think that the bases of power in Pyongyang are going to be regretful about that byproduct of the missiles, put it that way.
It's an eternal question about North Korea, John, which I know we've discussed before, but I'll put it again in the current context. In between North Korea's recent build-up in activity with missiles, the deployment of the THAAD missiles, the presence in the White House of Donald Trump, et cetera, how close are we getting to a point at which someone, whether it's South Korea, Japan, the United States, or China, just decides they have entirely lost patience with Pyongyang and something decisive needs to be done sooner rather than later?
I suspect that we may be uncomfortably close to just that point. It's difficult to give a more precise answer because it's in the nature of the conversations about such things that nobody is going to give anybody a lead in. We will discover that that point has been reached when we turn on our television sets and see tanks on the streets of Pyongyang. But yes, there's a real risk. Coming back to the point you made earlier, the Chinese are hoping to get some kind of traction with this rather curious Trump administration, not just over THAAD. Of course, the other big issue outside the Korean Peninsula is the deployment of a US naval task force to the South China Sea, which has really alarmed the Chinese. And I'm quite sure that one of the reasons that they're doing what they're doing over the Korean Peninsula is an attempt to build bargaining chips with the United States for an eventual conversation over that.
Just a final thought from you on this one, John. In the next few days and weeks, what sort of development should we be looking for? Is it another provocation of some sort from North Korea likely? They seem to be on a bit of a roll lately.
They are on a roll, as you put it. Likely, indeed foretold. One of the statements they made straight after the killing of Kim Jong-nam was that they're going to strengthen their self-defense, which is North Korea speak for another big bang somewhere, possibly yet another nuclear test, we'll have to see. But this isn't going to get quiet anytime soon. It's going to get a lot worse before it gets better, and it could get nasty.
Okay, well, let's move along now to this week's document dumped by WikiLeaks, which yesterday published thousands of what it claimed were CIA documents detailing the hacking capacities of American intelligence. Listeners still waiting for WikiLeaks to unleash proof of the malfeasance of Russian spooks would probably be ill-advised to hold their breath. The headline revelation, if revelation it was, is that the CIA is able to spy on people via their smartphones and smart televisions. Samira, have you yet begun blue-tacking your laptop camera, lining your living room with tin foil, etc., etc.?
Well, there's probably a bit of a gap between the two, between those two actions, isn't there? No, I haven't actually, but it is nerve-wracking, isn't it? Because everyone's got these devices, and we're so kind of reliant on them. Maybe not everyone has a smart TV. I don't, but most people have a smartphone. You've got a laptop. You're sort of using these things all the time. So I think that it's just one of those things where technology has been developing so quickly over the last 10 years or so, and it's developing to a point that we become reliant on it very quickly. We use it very quickly. Indeed, these things are designed to be very usable and to make us reliant very quickly, and they're useful, all of these things. So you kind of get swept along in that without really keeping pace with the risks or the ways that those things could potentially be exploited. And I think that our use of technology and the development of technology has in no way sort of been kept pace with our awareness of what the pitfalls of those might be. So I think that it's, you know, sort of leaks like this, it, the main use I would see is sort of making people aware that we need to be more educated about digital security and about protecting your information and all of those things. I mean, you see it at a most basic level in people's social media accounts, you know, people not knowing that they haven't set privacy settings or whatever, and they're broadcasting out personal information to their colleagues or whatever it is. But at a much more serious level, sort of not knowing about your financial information or whatever it is, it's not just from governments that this is a risk, it's from all sorts of sources, and we all need to be sort of better educated and more aware about it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I would say that. I mean, yeah. When it comes to CIA or SIS holding this kind of software, I would want to be reassured there's proper democratic vigilance over what they do. I know from my own professional experience just how careful SIS in particular are about launching any kind of operation. They always check very carefully that it doesn't break laws, that it achieves proper objectives, all this kind of stuff. And I'm pretty sure the CIA do the same. I think the real risk is not that it is in the hands of controlled government agencies. It is what happens if this kind of ability gets into the criminal world. I mean, what
we would have to assume that it will or it has.
Will we? I mean, there's an awful lot of tricks that the CIA have that haven't got into the criminal world. They're quite good at keeping hold of their technical assets. Whether this one will eventually, well, let's see. If it does, I mean, the consequences are unthinkable. Assassinations by remote control, as the article has pointed out, and easy eavesdropping on people you're trying to abduct, for example, intimidate, blackmail. You know, this is nasty stuff.
Except, don't you get to the point where, Samira, what always makes me wonder about anything like this is that surely the intelligence services just end up hoovering up loads of pointless crap about people they couldn't be possibly less interested in, because people presumably with something they might want to hide from authorities will take actual steps to hide it.
Well, I think that's one of the differences, though, between this stuff that's been revealed and the ability to sort of get into people's TV sets and phones and stuff. That's, I think, slightly different to the broad-scale monitoring that was revealed by the NSA leaks and stuff like that. So the nature of it means that it has to be reasonably targeted. Obviously, they can get the wrong targets, and I'm sure do, but they're not... feasibly, you couldn't have people listening through every smart TV in the country or whatever, or every smartphone. It's more about the fact that you can use this stuff, and maybe kingpins might of organizations or whatever might have the wherewithal to protect that those pieces of technology, but someone else might not. If you're looking at, say, terrorist networks or whatever it is, or organized crime, maybe someone lower down the chain doesn't think to, or until this point doesn't know that their smartphone could be used to bug them or whatever it is. So I think that's the. I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily true that everyone who would be a target would be able to avoid scrutiny. But I do think it's worrying that, you know, these things are so ubiquitous. It's quite unnerving if you sort of think about these things that we sort of carry around with us all the time. That they could be used to, yeah.
All intelligence services suffer from massive, massive information overload. DCHQ, NSA in particular, you with the electronic stuff, only use a tiny fraction of 1% of the stuff that they are able to collect. I mean, most people are in no danger, whatever. Yes, there's a technical ability to listen into a smartphone, a smart TV, whatever. Yeah. There's absolutely no way they're going to do that. I mean, they couldn't
come anywhere. It's expensive as well to do it on everyone. Yeah.
It'd be prohibitively expensive. You're quite right. And also, the results that you get will be absolutely useless. You just get a mass of completely useless information. Targeting is everything in intelligence, and only people that the agencies have an interest in, I think, have got anything to fear.
John, we do prevail upon you frequently on these programs to decode various diplomatic euphemisms for us. Which I guess applies just as much to the corporate world as the governmental one. What strikes me in these statements from the companies who have been named of complicity in this, whether wittingly or unwittingly, Apple, Samsung, Microsoft, Google, not one of them is saying anything like this is absolute nonsense, it's completely impossible, could never happen. They've all said stuff like, we're looking into it. What does that mean, John?
It means, yes, this is going on. Bullseye.
I mean, Samir, what it makes me wonder is if there's going to be a gap in the market for, I guess, a resurgence, if you will, of dumb products. you know, phones that don't have cameras, TVs that can't talk to you.
Carrier pigeons.
Yeah, I would have thought so. I mean, actually, I think last time I was in here, we were talking about the relaunch of the Nokia 3310. And I
Indeed.
Just heard a couple of people talking about, sort of just anecdotally reading those stories yesterday and saying, I just want to get one of those old flip phones or something. I think there definitely will be interest in that for people who are conscious of privacy. I think for the majority of people, probably... I think that the convenience offered by a smartphone would trump those concerns. We've seen that with all sorts of other issues around privacy and the internet. You know, there's lots of different things that we use all the time that have absolutely terrible records on protecting privacy and data and so on, like Facebook or like, you know, iCloud, all these different things. And people continue to use and think, oh, isn't that really bad? It sounds complicated. I'm not going to look into it too much and keep using it. I think my hunch would be that would be the same probably with smartphones. But, you know, you might well start to see a kickback against that. And also people questioning, why can't companies close those loopholes themselves? If governments are finding all these loopholes in the security sort of security technology set up by companies, why can't companies troubleshoot that first?
I wonder whether this will make us go back to writing letters, you know, with pen, ink, remember those? Paper? We'll see.
Too slow.
or in invisible ink, lemon juice, for example, on a piece of paper, which you then need to run over a slow candle. Again, somewhat time-consuming. But, John, final thought on this one. One of the ironies of this, of course, is that we only know about this stuff because, as it turns out, or as it appears to have turned out, an actual intelligence service can't keep its own secrets. Do we all need to get used to the idea, both intelligence services and private citizens, that secrets don't have the currency they once did?
No, secrets are still as current as they are. You just never, never write them down.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Samira Shackle and John Everard. Coming up next, the eternally troublesome border between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Istanbul, our bureau chief is Christopher Lord.
For us here at Monocle, Turkey has a vital position, not just in the Eastern Balkans, but also looking towards the Middle East, towards Central Asia, and towards these countries that are very, very quickly emerging economically. But Turkey also occupies an extremely important role over the next few years, that's in terms of a kind of economic model, and also in terms of city building, as a model of how you make sure that you're building a society that can continue to evolve and change as that population evolves and changes too.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Tall Stories is a new 5-minute audio snack from the team who bring you The Urbanist each week. In just a few minutes, we talk about one building, one statue, one park bench that has an interesting backstory, something special to reveal to us about life in the city in all shapes and sizes. Sometimes we'll get all historical on you, other times we might be yearning for modernity. But it's 5 minutes of urban diversion, an unplanned journey down the secret side streets of metropolitan life that will, we hope, keep you intrigued. Available every Monday, you can get it by subscribing to The Urbanist via monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. Be a part of the story.
You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and John Everard. And we'll look now at one of the most porous and persistently troublesome borders, the so-called Durand Line, which divides Pakistan and Afghanistan. Thousands of people have been queuing to cross in both directions after Pakistan closed the gates 3 weeks ago after a spate of terror attacks in Pakistan. Afghanistan complained that some 25,000 of its citizens had been stranded. Those crowds have now started to move, but very, very slowly. Samira, this region famously, and certainly this was probably still a current fact last time I was there, which was in 1998, it was said to be at the time the world's single biggest refugee population. These were Afghans who'd left Afghanistan during the Civil War. You were there more recently. Has that decreased at all? How many of those huge, sprawling refugee cities have gone home?
I mean, it's still, if you're in Peshawar, if you get the very strong feeling that of Afghanistan being so close by. There's lots of Afghan people there, and many of whom have now been settled there for years and years and years, in not just in Peshawar, all over Pakistan, and particularly in that province, in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, which is near to Afghanistan. And it's just, even apart from the refugees who are based there all the time, it is so porous, the border. I mean, I spent some time in the major government hospital in Peshawar this time last year. They get hundreds of people every day who've just sort of walked across the border from Afghanistan for medical treatment, just because it's better than the hospitals in the region on the other side of the border. So it's a really casual border crossing. As you know, we hear a lot, it's this incredibly porous border. What that means day to day is people going back and forth to sell goods, people going back and forth to get medical treatment, people going back and forth for all sorts of things, in a really sort of not in a way that they'll even treat with the significance of foreign travel a lot of the time. It's really, really porous. And that's, I mean, you can't also discount the fact lots of Afghans do live in Pakistan. And that's the great irony, I think, of this border being closed, sort of at least the formal points along this border being closed. It would be meaningless to suggest you could close the whole 1,600 kilometre.
This is what
border.
I was wondering. I mean, I'm given to understand that they've beefed up the actual crossing at Torkham since I was last there, when it was literally a wooden gate, which, having got my passport back from the officer from the Khyber Rifles, I just picked up my bag, literally opened the gate and walked into Afghanistan. But nobody else was having their passports checked in any other direction. And as you say, there are paths through the mountains and hills.
People just wander back and forth all the time. But the irony of this is that, you know, the last few years, there's been a real sort of harsh crackdown on undocumented Afghan refugees in Pakistan, of whom there are loads. And you know, there's lots of people there who, families who are now in their second or third generation in Pakistan, and with kids who've never set foot in Afghanistan, who don't have the proper documentation because the bureaucracy doesn't exist for them to get it necessarily. There have been wide-scale crackdowns in all the major cities, and people being forcibly deported to Afghanistan, some of whom have never been to Afghanistan ever. They were born in Pakistan. So that's happening. The great irony is that now they're not letting Afghans back into Afghanistan. So it seems like quite a strange policy when you've been pursuing forcible deportations with quite a lot of vigour over the course of a few years.
John, there are, of course, obvious echoes here of situations elsewhere around the world. I mean, as a general rule, are crackdowns, especially on land borders, are they in... I mean, unless you're prepared to build something like the demilitarized zone across the Korean Peninsula, is any move like this, such as the one that Pakistan has made, is it basically symbolic? Is it? Are we in the realm of something must be done, this is something, therefore we must do it?
Yes, I think there are big elements of symbolism, as you say. Also, you have to recognize that crackdowns like this, closing water, this is a poor country's response to a problem. It becomes entirely symbolic where, as Samir just pointed out, you can simply walk around the border post. The border is far too long to control. And in any case, it's not what a more effective state would ever do. If you have people trying to enter your territory from a neighbouring country, you're worried about this, you want to prevent it, you don't close the border. You simply make sure that all the border guards are looking out for these people. You have identification papers put out to them, and you probably increase the number of checkpoints that you go through, because you know that the extra checks on each individual point are going to slow the flow. Now, there are well-established, well-practiced ways of doing this. But clearly, neither Pakistan nor let alone Afghanistan have got the resources for such finesse, and so they simply bring a sledgehammer to the nut.
There is a bigger question here, and a final thought on this one from you, Samira, that the world's attention became focused on the Northwest Frontier Province, of course, on approximately September 12, 2001, when it became apparent to a lot of people how completely lawless and indeed probably ungovernable it actually was. Has the Pakistani state established anything like a rule of Pakistani law inside the NWFP in the last 15 or 16 years, or is it still the bandit country it always was?
That's the federally administered tribal area. So the NWFP is now known as KPK. That is the writ of the state does exist there. The tribal areas, the FATA, as it's called, Federal Administered Tribal Areas, remains pretty lawless. There's been a quite large-scale Pakistani military intervention there, again, sort of trying to root out militant hideouts, which obviously people have just sort of hopped back across the border to Afghanistan for the most part. So, no, I don't think the writ of the state exists in any meaningful way there. It's quite militarized at the moment, but it's not not effectively governed or governable at present, I think.
OK, well, finally tonight, this International Women's Day, which is today, Nike have planted a stake in the female Islamic clothing market, unveiling, if that is indeed the word in the circumstances, a hijab for female Muslim athletes. The headgear is made from breathable fabric and features an elongated back, which it says here will prevent untucking mishaps. It will initially be available in black, grey and obsidian and will go on sale next year. Samira, is this a huge leap forward? Women have, of course, been competing in hijabs of some sort or another, if I suspect quite often largely improvised, for a while.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite the leap forward that Nike would like us to think it is. It's obviously, you know, it's got the, this story kind of has the hallmarks of a big corporate launch. I think that these sports hijabs have existed for years, made by lots of companies, and I think the whole sort of surge, and there's been quite a lot of articles I've seen around about the surge of in Muslim fashion and modest fashion, and that's basically about Western brands sort of seeing that the possibility for monetizing this enormous market. It doesn't mean that fashion didn't exist before. It's existed for many years in the Gulf and other places. Things like sports hijabs being mass produced by big companies. It's just that now it's being done by a big Western corporation, and that's the difference.
John, is there a, I guess, cause for optimism here? My improvised theory being that there's something about commercial necessity or commercial opportunity which can actually serve as an engine of inclusion and social progress, if you like, as the market realises that all these hitherto excluded people are potentially a huge customer base.
Yes, up to a point. I mean, my sense is that, you know, that the Muslim women who want to wear a hijab doing sport have been doing so for quite some time. Whether they bought one, as Amir suggested, from other manufacturers who got there some time ago, or are just wearing an ordinary hijab, you know, while they do their workout. I mean, in my local gym, there's any number of Muslim women, and none of them seem to sort of be suffering from the lack or the previous lack of a special Nike brand with the tick hijab. They just come along in their ordinary ones. I have to say also that the pictures of this wonder garment do suggest it is seriously dull. I mean, it comes out in, was it black obsidian and sort of a kind of washy, washy grey, doesn't it?
I imagine more vibrant colours in national flags, etc., will become available in due course.
Well, all right, we wait the big moment, but I have to say that, you know, Muslim women I see around me tend to wear much brighter colours than that. You know, why should they go back to wearing such dull things?
It will, of course, attract attention, as such stories always do, Samira, but what is it about the hijab in particular, as we have seen in any number of arenas in the last few years, does have extraordinary power to annoy people? I mean, they're usually the people who most deserve to be annoyed, but what is it about it?
I think it's partly that it's a very visible symbol of religion. I mean, Islam is often criticised, I think, and you know, there's lots of Islamophobia around. There's lots of controversy, I think, and so I think that's a very visible symbol that becomes something, becomes a sort of conduit for all sorts of arguments about multiculturalism and all sorts of things which aren't really about the hijab at all, I think, which are about sort of culture clashes and various different things. And so this garment becomes a way of, if you're ostensibly talking, say, about the rights of women or what women wear or whatever, becomes a way of talking about which values are compatible with which values. And I think that's partly why you see quite so much airtime given to it.
John, is there the idea that at least if my previous theory about commercial necessity driving inclusion might have been a bit over-egged, but I think there's something to it. Does the idea that this is just regarded as a normal garment that some people happen to wear, can that act as a kind of agent of inclusion? In the same way that when it becomes permissible for, I guess, observant Sikh policemen to wear turbans rather than helmets, etc.?
Well, yes, I think that's right. I mean, it's interesting that way back in 2014, wasn't it, when FIFA finally relaxed their ban on soccer players wearing headgear, it wasn't just the hijab that was in question. The Sikhs also were protesting. They wanted to be able to wear turbans because that's what Sikhs do. Yes, you know, this kind of relaxation, commercially driven or whatever, is going to prompt us towards inclusion. Let's see more of it.
Well, on that optimistic note, John Everard and Samira Shackle, thank you for joining us. That's all for today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anthea Longo. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Music next at 1900, The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli, and I'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.